Banking has become less about traditional banking and more about technology. Banking is shifting away from legacy processes and systems. The founders of Zenja, a neobank in Australia, saw a unique opportunity to disrupt the banking landscape. Neobanking provides a blank canvas where Zenja can use artificial intelligence and cloud services to create its products. Neobanks are completely digital and build their own tools and applications from scratch. Zenja is taking innovative steps to create something special with its customers. It has provided ownership opportunities through crowdfunding. A community forum has been mindfully cultivated to provide a place where ideas can be shared and valuable feedback is captured. Zenja is committed to giving its customers hope and providing ways to improve their financial well-being. In this episode, Van Lee, co-founder of Zenja, joins me for a conversation about Zenja, the future of neobanking, and competing with the big four banks in Australia. Van Lee is the Chief Strategy, Innovation, and Design Officer and co-founder of Zenja. Van, welcome to FinTech Daily.
Thanks very much for having me.
So let's start by giving our listeners just a bit about your background and how you came to co-found a bank.
So the short answer is I met with our founder and CEO, Eric Wilson, a number of years ago, and he was telling me about he's starting a bank, and he asked whether I wanted to be a part of it. And immediately I saw, you know, one of those unique opportunities to disrupt an industry that has not significantly changed or done anything new in quite a long time, particularly in Australia anyway. And at that point in time, it had been at least 25 years or so since Australia had had a new bank or issued a new banking license. And there was so much great, you know, disruption happening in other industries, new business models, none of which had really started to touch banking as we knew it. There was a lot happening in fintech, in particular slices of the financial services industry, but nothing that dealt with the nuts and bolts of banking. And so the opportunity to reimagine that whole world and reimagine what the role of banks could be for customers was one of those opportunities that was one of those offers that was too good to refuse.
Excellent. That sounds great. And we'll definitely get more into the details about that here in a few minutes. But kind of get back to the fact that you mentioned it had been a couple of decades since anything really significant had happened in the industry and in Australia. So if you think about the U.S., where there's banks like Capital One and Bank of America and Wells Fargo, they take up a large portion of the market. They're some of the bigger players. And in Australia, you've got Commonwealth Bank and Westpac Bank, and those are some of the bigger players there. So take us one step further around the financial landscape in Australia and how, you know, neobanks are starting to get into that realm.
Yeah, sure. So in Australia, the structure of our banking landscape is very much an oligopoly. We have four major banks, I think in the UK they'd be called Main Street banks, that pretty much have the majority market share in Australia. And from what customers tell us, their experience is that, you know, there's not much of a difference between how these big four banks operate. And you know, there may be slight differences in the way that their mobile apps function and what customers are able to do through their mobile devices, but the level of customer service is still generally low compared to what customers expect. Customers experience being treated worse if they are a loyal customer who's been there for years compared to being a new customer. And, you know, one of the events that has recently happened in the industry is the Banking Royal Commission that started to look into a range of behaviours by the industry that have really left customers quite, I suppose, with a lost sense of trust in these institutions that used to be pillars of the community.
Yeah, definitely. And that we're seeing that in the United States as well. Banks are kind of changing their models. They're changing how they even reach out to different demographics. So you're seeing banking cafes and things that are really kind of unique and would not have been even thought of 10 years ago. So the customer service realm and play in that regard is definitely changing things. So it's good to know that those problems exist everywhere and there are people, smart people like you, that are tackling those. So I want to get into neobanking now. And Zinja's a neobank. For those that don't know, it's something that's completely digital, and you've developed all your tools and applications from scratch. And it sounds very daunting, to be honest. And so when you were approached about starting a bank, you know, why was it important for you to go down the path of a neobank? And just kind of take us through and just summarize the process of getting a bank off the ground.
Sure. So, you know, the very word neobank, it's no accident that the term neo or new is in there. And, you know, when we look at, you know, our purpose behind Zinja, you know, what we're really wanting to do is take away the fear and bring hope to people around their finances and money, and to help them make more out of their money. And, you know, we asked ourselves the question, you know, why isn't that already happening with banking the way that it is? And what we saw was really needed was that the experience of dealing with banks and dealing with money really needed to change. And the only way to do that, and, you know, in Australia, we've actually tried to regulate a lot of this so that, you know, the industry was moving that direction, but it wasn't really having the kind of impact that disruption and new entrants could have. But more importantly, banks and banking needed to be reimagined from scratch. The day-to-day money interactions needed to be redesigned from scratch. It needed to be free of legacy systems and legacy manual processes, legacy decision-making that needed to be validated, the legacy silo operations that we see in these institutions. We needed to be free of the legacy culture as well that has also come into banking, as well as the legacy leadership, and most critically, the legacy thinking about the way things should be or the way things can be. And this is very much the pathway of a neobank. You know, we saw the possibilities of starting with this blank canvas and then being able to add purpose and entrepreneurship and a new technology stack, add on to that data sharing and open APIs, AI, this increasing trends around the digitization of assets, and then add in gamification, bring all of this together to create easier and ethical and educational ways for customers to get ahead with their money with an entirely new next generation business model that's both for purpose and for profit, and to reduce the risk for customers of engaging with something new. So whilst creating a neobank from scratch is definitely the harder pathway, we saw that this is really the platform that was needed to really bring that purpose to life. Now, the process of getting a bank off the ground in some ways is quite similar to getting any other startup off the ground. You know, you need to have your purpose. You need to know what problem you're solving and how you want to solve it. You need to have a business model and know how you're going to make money out of this and make it sustainable without having to screw people over in the process. You need a strategy, you need a business plan, you need to raise money to get this off the ground. And, you know, once we had our first round of funding, the Series A, you know, 2.5 mil or so that we raised, then we went on to design and build the team. Finding the right people is really important. And also designing what the user experience needs to look like across the entire customer relationship and customer journey, not just the products and services in themselves. And then you want to have a look at your technology architecture and how that will enable all of that, and your processes, and design and build your brand and culture. And that's the building side of things. But it's also really important to set the boundaries early for what you will and won't do in the process of, you know, building your bank and getting it off the ground. And then, of course, a critical part of that is getting a banking license. In Australia, it's actually illegal to call yourself a bank unless you have a banking license. And then there's acquiring customers, serving them well, doing everything you can not to screw it up, but also, you know, being accountable when things do go wrong and never lose sight of why you're here.
That's really, really exciting. Just the idea of starting from scratch and really putting your stamp on it and not having to worry about really what anybody else thinks. Like, you've got your mission and you're going for something that's going to be revolutionary and really going to impact people in a positive way. So it's really exciting to hear you talk about treating it like a startup. And I know a lot of people can relate to that. So it's very, very cool. So who are some of your competitors in the space, and how are you separating yourselves from those other folks?
We see our key competitors as the big four in Australia, or the mainstream banks that are here. What we saw in the UK and also Europe with the rise of neobanks is that most of their customers came from the major banks. And when we say the major banks, you know, in some ways what we're really competing with is the way that banking has always been done. One of our customers actually said, you know, as millennials, we do everything differently to our parents except banking. Banking is exactly the same. So in some ways, the competition is always just the status quo of how things are at the moment. And part of that is also enshrined in one of our golden rules at Syngerin, that, you know, we're here to make money and we're not shy about that, but we're not going to screw people over to do that. And when we have a look at, you know, the current state of the financial system, there's the institutional level experiences that people have, but it's also, you know, the individual experiences people have around financial stress. And we're also looking at, you know, competing with the current state of financial literacy and financial capability and financial resilience that customers have. And we see that that impacts different customers differently. So we're also competing with how people struggle on a day-to-day basis to make more out of their money and, you know, how they're currently making money decisions without, you know, all the angst that can go with that.
Yeah, one thing we definitely talk about on this podcast is financial literacy, and it's certainly very inspiring to know that you are focused on helping people with that also. So I think that's another avenue that's been opened up to you in this industry. So, you know, where do you see the future of neobanking going? I do greatly appreciate the fact that you're not even really comparing yourself or competing with the other neobanks in Australia. You're going after the big four. And I think that's what any real entrepreneur would want to do. So where do you see the future of neobanking going in Australia and globally?
So I think probably firstly, neobanking right now has an incredible opportunity to set a new foundation for trust with customers, trust that was lost through the GFC, trust that's been lost through just the behavior of large organizations in that imbalance of power between institutions and the individual consumer. So there's, you know, an amazing opportunity here to really start again and to build and earn that trust from scratch. And whilst right now we're talking about the trust that relates to putting your money in a new bank that has, you know, very little track record, I suppose, compared to other banks, the licensing process is there to give customers some comfort around the safety of their money. But where we see the whole neobanking industry going is actually, I suppose, that intersection of money and data, especially as money becomes much more digitized and the data around where people spend their money, how they save, becomes, I suppose, a really interesting place for us to give customers better insights into their behaviors, what happens when you combine their banking and spending data with other data that they have. For example, their, you know, other apps that people use on their phones, whether it's Uber or Amazon or fitness apps, you know, what happens when you can bring open data together, and open banking is just one component of it. But what happens when you bring open data together to create these hyper-personalized experiences and services for customers? And we don't know yet what those emerging needs will look like, but we do see this, you know, significant opportunity in that space. So whilst it may start with, you know, greater digital experiences for customers that are entirely mobile-based, I think where it can go will, you know, I suppose, go through a bit of an innovation curve in and of itself. You know, the immediate things are instant payments, international passporting, 24/7 banking, taking all the inconvenience and the waiting out of day-to-day banking. But then it'll start to touch on, you know, new digitized assets, new user experiences, really dig into this segment of one and the quantified self, all the way through to personalized pricing or behavior-based pricing, where banks can reward customers for positive credit and saving behavior. And I suppose in terms of the future of neobanking overall, it will demonstrate that there's, you know, better ways for banks to do business with customers, to leave customers better off. And the real winners in this space, I believe, whether they are the neobanks or existing established banks, will be those banks that actually demonstrate how hard they are fighting to create genuine new value for customers, not just more of the same with a new brand plastered over the top or just a digital app plastered over the top.
Fantastic. And we touched on this a little bit in the beginning, but when it comes to your customers and you're really taking a different approach to some of the legacy and quote old school ways of banking. So let's start with the fact that since you are a neobank, you don't have branch locations, no one's going to come into an office and get money out. So talk about how, since you don't have branch locations, what's your customer service model look like?
So I suppose underlying our entire approach to customer service and customer experience is building Zinger from scratch to be able to enable anyone in the business to be able to have a 360-degree view of our customers and what's happening with them. How long has this customer been with us? What range of products and services do they use? What are the most common things that they do when they interact with us through the app? You know, what was their last interaction with us? And that's the kind of data that becomes much more readily available when your entire service model is digital. So Zinger itself becomes available to customers through our Zinger app on their mobile phones. And much of what we want to be able to do is enable customers to self-service. But when they do need to interact with us, it should feel like interacting with a friend on WhatsApp. And part of our app is designed to enable in-app chat, very much like how you'd chat to someone on WhatsApp. But of course, if you still need to talk to someone, you can absolutely do that. We've invested quite a lot in finding amazing people who are just about customer service at heart. And those are the people that our customers interact with when they're talking to us through the app. It's a genuine human on the other end, not someone who's been trained to be clinical and overly formal. It's a real human being, but in the sense of here's another person who cares about what's going on for you, as opposed to here is someone who's just ticking the boxes and just trying to make sure they don't screw up. Although that is important, not screwing up.
Certainly. And we can all appreciate the fact that a lot of the, you know, customer service or help desk calls are largely automated. And there was a period of time where it was just frustrating to keep hitting, you know, press one, press four, or press seven. So that was certainly a time to do that. Yeah. But it's obviously not very friendly, or, you know, there's no personal touch with that. So it's great that you're able to, you know, use chat through the app, which is a lot of people use now anyway. But then there are just certain times when the voice of a human with some compassion just kind of makes things go a lot more smoothly. So I'm sure everyone appreciates that. And the other thing I guess I want to ask is just around how have you streamlined the process of opening a new account for your customers?
This is one of the areas I was alluding to earlier in terms of the real possibilities that are available right now with open APIs and data and technology just being where it is. For a Zinger customer to open a new bank account, it's something that can happen in minutes entirely from the Zinger app itself. But actually, we've designed the experience to take the fewest data points necessary from a range of ID documents, and just those few data points can be enough to open a new bank account entirely in minutes that can be used straight away.
Excellent. So now I want to flip a little bit to your customers. And I really got the sense that, you know, from learning about Zinger through your website and speaking with my colleagues and then speaking within the first few minutes here, you treat your customers like family, like friends. And that's certainly new to the banking industry, at least, you know, relatively new in this regard. So I want to talk through some of the community aspects of it that really piqued my interest. But let's start with what your typical customer look like. What's your target demographic?
So in our early days, we attracted, as you can expect, many early adopters. These tended to be fintech enthusiasts, people in the industry, people who just loved seeing new apps, those who are very tech-minded, and ironically, a lot of bank employees, as you can imagine. But as we started to grow, we were also getting a lot of interest from people who were just simply fed up with banking and have had frustrating experiences, people who just wanted banking to be easier, less confusing, a little bit more common sense as well. They were finding it strange that, you know, just basic common sense seemed to be lost in this sea of process and constantly hearing, you know, we can't do this or we can't do that. And some of them were actually, you know, very angry, to be honest, about the way they've been treated with their existing banks, especially those who've been with their existing bank for a number of decades. So to some degree, a lot of our customers are, I suppose, defined by this mindset that they have around wanting the whole experience and the industry to be better rather than a particular demographic. But to talk about demographics for a moment, we do have a lot of under 45s. And within that, I suppose, age group, we've got everyone from management consultants to emergency nurses to business owners to students who want to travel. And, you know, our oldest customer is if I remember correctly, 102, or is it 82?
Oh, wow.
We'll have to come back to you on that. But there's quite a range there in terms of who we speak to in terms of our brand and our value proposition.
Okay, very good. And the other thing that really kind of piqued my interest was this, the community forum and things about how you're actually letting people, to an extent, kind of drive the future of the app and allow them to make comments and things like that. So talk about how you've been able to basically empower people, your customers, to even give relative feedback on the app that you can take and distill and make something new out of it, and without trying to please everybody, but how are you going about it in a smart way that's enabled you to consider their feedback as well as, you know, being smart about the company and kind of moving forward together?
Yeah, absolutely. When we first started, you know, one of the things that I personally did at the very beginning was I just got out there and started talking to people. I probably did about 40 in-depth interviews, and some of them were, you know, movie length interviews. People had a lot to say, and I discovered that, you know, people don't often get asked what they think about banking or how it should be, what it's like dealing with money on a day-to-day basis. And it was really important for us to hear what life is like for people. Very few people actually think about their banks. They think about what doesn't work when things go wrong. But, you know, people are concerned with, you know, just getting through life on a day-to-day basis and how money comes into that. You know, we heard about, you know, what money is like for couples. There's usually one person who's the money person, and then there's usually someone who's not. And some of those conversations we heard turn into days of not talking to each other after having to deal with, you know, the annual family budget. Mm-hmm. We heard what it's like for parents to, you know, have to say no to their kids. We heard about, you know, really, you know, heartbreaking stories about, you know, victims of domestic violence and what it's like going from, you know, living in a huge house to being homeless with four kids and having to choose between paying the car insurance or paying for your kids to go to the school disco that week. And so we learned a lot about some really tough choices that customers make on a day-to-day level, yeah. But all the way to, you know, people who are having to put their money in multiple accounts in different places because there isn't one single thing that has everything that they need. So talking to people and understanding where the fear and the anxiety and the hope is was really important. People often don't get asked those things unless the bank wants something out of it. You know, if you've ever done a typical bank customer survey, it's not, you know, the most personalized or personal experience to go through. So it was important to us for customers to basically constantly be listening to customers and to make it as easy as possible for customers to tell us what works for them and what doesn't, not only in the industry, but also in our own products and services themselves. So there's a few different aspects to this. We do regular usability testing. We also have blue sky ideation with our customers through our Zinja Labs. As you mentioned, we also have our community forum that anyone can be a part of, where, you know, we will ask particular questions that we'd like feedback on, but we also provide the opportunity for customers to post about anything and everything that's important to them. We also did two rounds of crowdfunding over the last few years that enabled customers to also become investors and shareholders in Zinja, and for us that sense of ownership, so that customers would really feel that this is their bank, something that they own and share in the profits of, was important to us. And we had many of those crowdfunding customers and investors also, you know, especially fly in just to come to our annual general meeting. Although I did wonder whether the beer and pizza may have been part of that. But, you know, what was it? People really loved being able to eyeball us and say, you know, this is what we really love about what you're doing, and this is what we'd really like to see happen. Because, I don't know, there's just something different about being able to, you know, talk to a founder or part of the starting team. And it's an experience you don't really typically get to have with your bank, to be able to talk directly to the people who are building this and doing this day to day.
Yeah, there's something really powerful about saying, this is not just the bank where I put my money, but this is my bank. Like, I'm personally invested, financially invested, and the people actually listen to me. So that's really powerful. It's very cool you've done that.
Yeah, and to be able to say, I've actually spoken to the CEO, or I've actually, you know, seen the Zinja tattoo that's on one of the co-founders. You know, it's very different when you can really create that human connection and that emotional connection between people as well as to brands.
Fantastic. And I did want to ask too about the community forum. So I've seen these forums in the past where it's always a great idea with great intentions, and this forum goes up and then it either turns into digital bathroom wall of just nonsense, or it takes a really long time to get people even interested in putting stuff out there. But when I looked through your forum, there were lots of questions, lots of comments, and things that look relevant and smart. And it was like, hey, let's have a conversation. So how long did it take to actually cultivate that and really make that something that's kind of gotten legs and taken off?
This is something that's definitely been a labor of love from the very beginning, and something we had hoped to do from our early days. And it did take us a while to get it up and running. There were, lots of challenging questions that we needed to work through. How are we going to manage it? How do we give people a voice? How do we make sure that the conversation is fair and respectful like any other community forum? And I think any other startup, it's one of those things where, you learn from the lessons that others before you have had. And then there are other things that you just don't know until you get in there and do it and start the conversation. It's always easy, I suppose, when you look at where the community forum is now and it looks like there's a lot happening there. But, in the first few weeks, you would have seen that there wasn't much at all. And, we would, I suppose, in starting the forum, we would have our monthly newsletters that would go out to customers to let them know, here's what's happening. We introduced the community forum. Here's what you can do with it. Go and try it out. We also found it was important to give customers the ability to go onto the forum anonymously so that they could say what they really thought. We wanted to take away any fear that customers had around their personal data so that they genuinely could have a voice and contribute without feeling like they would be punished or taking unnecessary risks at any level. But what we also committed to doing was making sure that we also responded to people's ideas as much as we could, so it didn't feel like, they were just putting things into a black hole, which is what can happen sometimes in some of these forums. And we wanted to get to a stage where people were also interacting with each other and building on each other's ideas, not just us. And because we've got such a great customer base of those early adopters, people who already think in that way, I think that's also contributed a fair bit to the forum being what it is as something that really is a voice for our customers. Now, when it comes to picking and choosing which ideas we take on, our approach is very much, it's just, in most cases, it's a matter of when, not whether. I don't think I've ever come across an idea that didn't make sense from customers in a particular context. So in terms of prioritizing, you might have seen we recently released our roadmap, our product roadmap specifically for our bank accounts. And we've asked people to provide feedback on that because we're really interested in, what really is hygiene? What are the things that people pay for today that they could actually live without? And what are the things that would actually really make a difference to their lives in a significant way? What are the things that people interact with often that would generate, daily value as opposed to things that might be a one-off? And at the same time, what are one of those things that you only ever have to deal with once in a while, but if it's not done right, it can ruin, someone's day. So these are all the things that we're really interested in hearing from customers. And for us, it's important not only to understand the what, but also the why and the context behind why people feel that something is particularly important or not. Is this someone who's already, got a home loan and has a house and, has a double income family? Or, is this someone who feels this way because they're a student? So that context behind the why is really important for us, because what we want to do with every step is to make decisions that can have a positive impact on as many people as possible in a shorter time frame as possible. And that's always been a guiding principle for us in these prioritization decisions. What will enable us to make the biggest impact for as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, and to keep building on that impact as we go?
Yeah, the product leadership aspect that you just kind of really well summarized there was really important to making sure that your customers hear you and you hear them. And I think that's very, very cool. Just kind of switching back to, how you got started and neobanking and some of the restrictions there. Zen just started out just by offering a prepaid card and not just an actual debit card. So kind of tell us why you had to start there. And now that you are an official bank, what products are you offering now?
So you might see that there's a number of different strategies for how neobanks become neobanks. And there are a number of startup banks out there that just went straight to getting their banking license first. and then building their customers and products after. For us, because we have such a strong design thinking approach and a lean startup approach to just building the whole business, we wanted to understand customers as early as we could to make sure that we were building the right thing. So it was important for us to find a way to start to build relationships with customers, to start to create some value and give customers a sense of who we are, what we do, and what it's going to be like interacting with Zinger at the customer service level. And so what we actually went down the path of starting with building the prepaid card at the same time as we were applying for our banking license to give customers that low risk way of getting to know Zinger. It's kind of like, you know, you don't jump into, you know, those really big commitments early on in a customer relationship. You want to give customers the ability to try you out with very little risk before saying to customers, hey, you know, do you want to think about Zinger becoming your main bank? It's hard to expect a customer to take that on if they've got no idea of you, your brand, what your customer service is like. So the prepaid card was really important for us to enable us to demonstrate to customers that we really are who we say they are. And also for us to learn, you know, what it was going to be like to build a product from scratch, to learn what customers really respond to, and to see how fast we could go as well.
All right. So let's switch gears a little bit and get into the technology just a little bit deeper. I read through the 10 golden rules on the Zinger site, and I thought that was a great list. I encourage everyone to read that after they listen to this podcast. But one of the golden rules is about everything being in the cloud. So which clouds are you using?
The main cloud we're using is AWS. At the moment, we have done an incredible amount of work to ensure that, you know, within the principles of having everything in the cloud, that everything also meets all of the requirements that we have around data protection, security, reliability, everything that you would expect from a bank to be bank grade in its technology. And we didn't see any reason why operating in the cloud should limit our ability to be as safe as any other bank. And actually, in some ways, operating in the cloud gives us better security tools, especially around monitoring, than you would with legacy technology. So as you mentioned, we don't have any physical data centers. We use AWS as a virtual data center. And our core banking system itself, the SAP Cloud for Banking Platform, uses best practice private and public cloud technologies to enable us to get that right balance between speed, innovation, security, reliability, and agility.
I do want to ask as well. So obviously, with all the new technology and some of the great things with data, as you mentioned earlier, AI, artificial intelligence is playing a really key part of all the new products and all the innovation that's happening. So if you can just kind of share how, like, what's your approach to AI, or maybe there's one or two products or services that you're working on or have worked on that incorporate AI?
So we've got a very long roadmap for AI and how we intend to use it. And there's probably two key, I suppose, areas where we are looking to direct AI. The building blocks for us for AI has to start with having enough data, though, to get going. You can't, you know, build great algorithms if you don't have a decent volume of data to start to work with. And this is, I think, one of the challenges for any neobank that is starting with no customers and needs to build that customer base over time, and then needs to build, if you like, that library of data and interactions. So for us, actually, the start of the journey is most likely to be open banking and open data to get a sense of what's happening for our customers and being able to bring in those multiple historical data sets. We're, you know, very much looking at what our data architecture is going to look like and starting to be very, I suppose, targeted around, you know, what are the questions that we want to be able to answer? What's the specific data we want to pull together? What are the algorithms going to be used for? And given that one of our intentions is to change and build and maintain new habits for people around money and new mindsets, you know, we're interested in what are the day-to-day interactions that would help customers down that path. So we're very much starting at the end in terms of the questions that we want to be able to answer, such as, you know, if someone's savings and spending habits continue, Where will they be in 5 months, 5 years, 50 years? And then being able to reverse engineer, how do we use AI to help answer those questions more quickly, but also to present some options for customers, almost as a choose your own financial adventure experience, so that people can start to see the different pathways that are open to them now and what their future might look like if they take one particular pathway or another. So these are the kinds of areas that we are looking at in terms of how we apply AI. The other is making it, you know, easy for customers to get answers to, you know, fact-based questions. But also we're interested in how do we use AI to enable our internal teams to do their jobs in a much easier way, take away the repetitive work that can be done through AI so that they can focus on those, I suppose, those higher order tasks that require some human judgment.
I really like the choose your own adventure concept. That's really cool. I'm excited to see how that gets fleshed out. But the other thing too, as far as, you know, being in charge of all your own technology, you have to be in charge of all your own security, and data protection, data privacy are really, really important, especially as we get further and further digitized and away from paper and things like that. So just obviously that's an important thing, but what is Zinja doing specifically to protect its customers' information and maintain that trust?
So as a starting point, there is no way you can get a banking license in Australia without addressing this very issue, because the data that you're dealing with isn't just data about customers. The data is also the transactions themselves and the authorization of the transactions, what time they happened, where they were meant to go. So this is something that we have to do anyway as part of our getting our banking license. As you can imagine, there is a lot of work that's gone into our data architecture, our security architecture. We've taken a risk-based approach where we've had to ask, what's anything and everything that could go wrong? How might it happen? What are the things that would be catastrophic to our customers, that would be catastrophic to our business? Where are the risks? How would we know that something's about to go wrong? What are the things that we need to monitor for and measure on a regular basis? And how do we make sure that we can respond appropriately when these incidents happen? And if everything does go down, how quickly can we get our systems back up and running again? How do we make sure that we can recover all of that historical data, especially transaction data? How do we make sure that, you know, this transaction belongs to this customer and not another? So the design of our risk management systems around data protection, information security, data recovery is one part of it, making sure that we've got, you know, what we're calling design effectiveness in those systems. But then there's also the testing of all of those systems to identify and monitor and measure and protect that data. We do extensive testing on all of those systems to make sure that they actually operate the way that we intend them to, and especially all the monitoring systems themselves. How do we make sure that the monitoring that we have in place works the way that it does? And then in addition to our own testing, the design and the testing of all of our risk management for effectiveness, we also have independent third parties that we engage to also literally try and break the bank, hack the bank. We've actually run internal break the bank hackathons to see, you know, how vulnerable our systems might be to all sorts of attacks. So there's a number of, I suppose, tech-focused and system and people-focused measures that we have around data protection and privacy and just the security of all of our systems. But right at the beginning of that whole chain, if I can come to protecting customer information and doing the right thing by customers, it also begins with making sure that we get customer consent under the right conditions, that it's not consent by default, but there's an active action to signify, yes, as a customer, I do want to give you this data. And especially as open banking comes in, it's quite important to us that we also give customers the ability to revoke that consent or take it back or change their mind at any point in time, because you can't expect to earn customers' trust if you give them no other option except to leave their data with you and, you know, for you to do whatever you want with it. So giving customers that sense of control and the freedom to change that at any point in time is also really important to us in being able to protect customer information and to protect the trust that they have in us.
Excellent. And so you touched on this a little bit in the beginning about your CEO having a Zenja tattoo, which I think is awesome. So obviously great companies have a great culture. So what's the culture like there as a Zenja employee?
So on that one, I couldn't speak on whether our CEO has a tattoo. We don't really have those kinds of conversations, but I do have one. I can talk about mine.
Oh, you have one. I'm sorry.
Yes, it might be quite inappropriate to talk about what's happening on other people's skin. You might just want to...
Yes, I apologize.
But yes, about 6 weeks after we started Zenja, I found myself at a tattoo parlor for the first time with our Zenja brand saying, yeah, I roughly want it there. And just in case this doesn't work out, what's the smallest size that you can do this? And it ended up being the size of a, you know, very large coin. It's the smallest size they could go. But at that time, I remember thinking, you know, this is one of those things that's going to be hard. There's going to be trying times. You're going to want to quit many, many times. And I wanted to make sure that there was a really good reason not to. And there's something about the pain of having to laser off a tattoo that can be very motivating when you're in a really dark hole and not sure how you're going to get out of it. Something that reminds you, you've got to keep going and not to give up. So yes, there's nothing like literally having skin in the game, but I digress. So coming back to the culture. So at the very beginning, our CEO started Zenja with essentially writing down 10 golden rules for how we were going to operate. And in a way, it was a reflection of everything that didn't work in the banking industry and everything that represented the kind of organization that we wanted to be. You know, the first of our golden rules is no dickheads, no matter how brilliant they are. And in many ways, that speaks to the kind of environment we see, you know, people working in day to day, you know, people who really want to make a difference. But it's really hard to do that in an environment where you're just interacting with people who behave like dickheads. But that rule also applies to us in how we interact with our customers, how we interact with each other, how we interact with our partners as well. And, you know, that's just the start of, you know, all 10 of our golden rules, which is all about an expression of the kind of environment that we want to create for people, what really matters to us and what's important to us. It's part of how we onboard our staff. It's there in every job description. And even before you get into the description of the job, there is a description of, you know, this is what we're trying to build at Zenja. And is this something that you want to be a part of? It's something that we keep coming back to when things get hard. It's something we come back to when there are tough decisions to make. But it also speaks volumes to how we listen to customers and empower our staff and the technology and our stakeholders to do everything that we can to act in our customers' interests. Because once you lose that, we're no longer Zenja, we're no longer for purpose and for profit, and we may as well just be another bank as opposed to one that's genuinely trying to disrupt not only the customer experience, but also just the way the industry works.
Very cool. So when I was looking through the Zenja site, I came across the 101 on Facebook Libra post. Obviously, Libra is coming at some point and will definitely do its best to totally disrupt digital currency as we know it. So have your customers talked about cryptocurrency at all or any other forms of digital payment?
There's been an incredible amount of discussion on cryptocurrencies. We've had questions such as, you know, is Zenja going to create a cryptocurrency? Is it going to create a cryptocurrency wallet? Is it going to be an exchange? How do I hold my cryptocurrencies inside my Zenja account? So our customers have been very innovative and open-minded in what a bank account should be and what it could be. And we're really interested to, you know, see what some of the pathways might be to enable that, but also interested in, you know, what's underneath that? You know, what's the problem that we can solve with this? And, you know, can this extend beyond money to any other type of digital assets? So some of this thinking has been really interesting for us to explore because it really challenges those traditional definitions of a bank, the traditional definitions of money, the traditional definitions of, you know, where do people store digital assets in a world where you don't need physical, you know, safes? You know, there was a time when the bank was just whatever the safest building in the community was, And that definition is changing. And is there any difference anymore between the digital asset being information about a customer or the digital asset being your bank balance or the digital asset being a cryptocurrency or, you know, any other, you know, an insurance certificate, for example, could be treated as a digital asset. So it's been really interesting hearing how customers are thinking about where this might go and what a next generation bank might look like. For us, we're very future looking and making sure that everything that we do today keeps the door open for us to be able to move in those directions, especially as we start to see the demand starting to grow. But we always keep coming back to first principles, you know, where can we solve a problem in this area that could also solve problems in numerous other areas for as many people as possible, and using that as a guiding principle for, you know, how we frame the problem that we're solving and also the solution that we want to bring to it.
And speaking of digital payments, WhatsApp is obviously taken over in many parts of the world. Is there a product or service like WhatsApp in Australia?
So WhatsApp is used by many people in Australia already as it is. And, you know, I think in terms of messaging, we probably still see Facebook Messenger dominating quite a fair bit. And this, you know, could possibly get even stronger with Libra. But WhatsApp is also out there as a very popular messaging tool that's used quite regularly as well. And actually all your standard social media channels as well. There's been a lot of talk about that intersection between messaging and payments. Mm-hmm. And this is just a personal view. What I expect to see happening over the next few years is for those apps that have already built enough customer trust, customers, and where there isn't a safer or better alternative, there's a natural opening for those messaging apps to start to offer payment services, especially if the trust is already there. And by the same token, I also see that in other apps, whether they're in financial services or any other industry or service where customer trust has already been built in or has already been earned, there's opportunities for them to expand into messaging or payments or any other field. I think the real gold is where that customer trust has been earned and then starting to engage in this open data economy that enables different apps and services to integrate and work with each other. As long as those organizations have solved that problem of protecting that customer data, especially when sharing with a third party. And this is why, in some ways, for us, being a neobank is also important in being able to build that trust. When you have to build bank-grade data and privacy security, you're already working with as much, I suppose, the highest grade of security that a person may want to have around their data. There's, you know, the level of security you might expect from, I don't know, let's say a car sharing app compared to the level of data security that you'd expect from a bank. It's just got this inbuilt level of security that just gives customers that next level of peace of mind around how their data is being used.
Great, great. So we touched on financial literacy a little bit earlier, and there's been a lot of talk about financial health products and things like that to really help consumers just kind of know what's going on with their money, maybe help them make better decisions with their money and things like that. So I'd like to hear more about what Zenja's doing to kind of help customers get educated on their financial health. And also, do you have any products or I guess services coming up in the pipeline that might help with the financial health platform or any kind of thing to help with financial literacy in that regard?
So what we found is that financial well-being is very similar to health and well-being in some ways, in that we all want to be healthy and fit, but the actual actions required to be healthy and fit aren't always all that pleasant. You know, getting up and getting to the gym isn't always a pleasant experience. Exercise actually comes with a certain level of pain. So there's, you know, the actual doing of it isn't always easy. It can be painful. Sometimes you're just not going to feel like it, but we all want the results. So one of the fundamental beliefs that we have is that if you make it easy and engaging and fun for people to get better with money, they will naturally get better at it. So we've been looking at, you know, what day-to-day interactions do people have with their money, and how do we build in knowledge, new mindsets and new interactions in there so that customers get that instant gratification that you can get from all the things that actually can be bad for you. You know, like when you go and to the store and you see something and you're able to just buy it straight away, there's a, you know, that hit of instant gratification you get with that. But when you don't spend or when you save, there's nothing. There's no one saying, well done, you didn't blow, you know, $100 today. So we're really interested in looking at how do we bring everything that we know motivates people into the day-to-day interactions that we have, and how do we actually combine that with actual data to show this activity here, whether it's, you know, 30 seconds to put money into your savings or 5 minutes to look at what's been happening with your money. Here's what that leads to over time, being able to show people, here's the reward at the end, but also here's a reward that we can create for you now. So this whole hypothesis that we have around how do we make it fun and engaging and essentially gamify this whole experience of taking on a financial journey to independence. How do we make that fun? How do we create rewards and milestones along the way so that it becomes more like an adventure or a game that you take on rather than, oh, one of these things that I know I really should do, but I can't get started. I don't know where I'm up to. And it can be a very isolating and solo experience as well, as opposed to something where someone's cheering you on and showing you how well you're doing every step of the way. So we're looking to build literacy and capability and financial independence just into the day-to-day interactions that people have with the app. We don't want it to feel like here's another course that you have to do and then you might become financially independent. Rather, we're focused on how do we build daily habits or daily mindsets that naturally lead to better financial outcomes for our customers, and having that all built in to just every little interaction that customers have with the Zinger app.
I think that's perfect. I think getting people to change their daily habits is really the biggest thing. It's one thing to save money for a vacation or pay off a credit card, but if you never actually built the habit of not getting into debt or putting money away every month with your paycheck or whatever, you're going to go back to the same thing. So I really appreciate the thought process around changing your daily habits and making your financial well-being better and better on a positive scale. That's fantastic. So yeah, just kind of wrapping up here, what's kind of the 1 to 3 year roadmap for Zinger, and how are you looking to scale and really take on the big four there in Australia?
So in some ways, we've built a lot of the fundamentals, especially around our core banking platform, our microservices layer, the Zinger platform itself, so that we've got the ability to rapidly test and try and iterate products and services for our customers. And we've also got, you know, very lean core banking system that's all built around. So we've got this foundation here, which has been designed to enable us to test and try new things quickly, learn to be able to respond quite quickly to what customers are looking for us to do, and to bring those products and services to market very quickly, but also, you know, with data threaded throughout all of that, so we can actually make really good data-based decisions, especially behavioral data based on how customers are interacting. So now that we've built those, I suppose, technology foundations, the focus over the next 3 years will be developing those value propositions, building them, testing the experience, and getting as many customers as we can in there so that we can learn what really makes a difference, especially to financial behavior and the things that don't, and being able to essentially put this whole experiment on steroids over the next 1 to 3 years. We're also interested to see, you know, what new ideas and possibilities emerge for new revenue models, new business models, new products and needs that we can cater to when you've got an entire technology stack that's designed to enable you to test multiple things at the same time, and a technology that is scalable, that can be picked up and used in any other part of the world for any other organization that wants to digitize their existing banking services, or anyone else who's looking at creating a neobank of their own, having a technology stack that's designed to be able to do exactly that, to cater for the localized needs of different customers, is something that's going to be a really exciting part of how we scale and grow over the next few years. While some challenges and hopes and fears are common, I think, across the globe in terms of financial independence and financial safety and security, the ways in which customers in different parts of the world want to do that and the challenges that they have within each of their own ecosystems from a technology and banking and even from a social perspective will require, you know, banks across the globe to operate very differently to, you know, address the underbanked, to bring services to people who just don't have, you know, a local branch available to them, to really unlock the power of technology being put into every smartphone to enable people to access services that they otherwise wouldn't have. So for us, in many ways, we see Australia as the test ground for the technology, for the design thinking approach, for how we understand how people behave. But we see this as something with the ability to scale to many, many other parts of the world.
Fantastic. Very excited to see how Zenja grows and looking forward to reading more about the community forums and some of the upgrades to the app as you move forward here. Any final thoughts for us, Van?
I think if anything, it's just a huge thank you to the amazing fintech and early adopter community out there. It's lovely to talk to people about the emergence of neobanks and what that really means in terms of being able to create something from scratch. You know, people talk about tech startups all the time, but the idea of creating a bank from scratch is, you know, quite a big one, but it's also one that I think has the potential to fundamentally change the industry for the better and to completely disrupt our relationship to money and banking and the amount of good that can be done. So really a thank you to all of your listeners for being interested in what's coming. And of course, we invite them all to be a part of our community forum to share their thoughts and also to, you know, use us as an opportunity to shape what that future might look like. And hopefully it'll be one that represents the hopes we all have for how banking could be and bringing humanity back to banking.
Absolutely. And we're excited to take that journey with you. Van Lee is the co-founder of Zenja. That's X-I-N-J-A. Thank you so much for being on FinTech Daily today with us.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
Mm-hmm.